Let me check with Trinity to give you this information. There's French translation, so those of you who would need handsets, please, there's a gentleman behind there who could assist you to get a handset. And there's also internet service. It is Property of Law Wireless number one. There's no password. Property of Law Wireless number one. There's no password. Thank you. Maybe now take the opportunity to listen to our second speaker, Manuel Sears Moses, on the topic of interaction of customary law, traditional religion, and status.
Thank you very much, Chair. In preparing this paper, I have concentrated more on matters as I see them in my country, Sierra Leone, and contains several controversial matters, from articles I have previously prepared for the meeting. So you forgive me if I raise some controversies in my discussion. Now, consider customary law itself as a generally accepted practice among persons in a community over a period of time, and so became adopted as the norm for that community, and does not need to be passed by any group of persons as a legislation. Now, 75% of our population is naturally governed by customary law, but with the advancement of education and Western influence, at least 50% of that number do not feel bound by customary law, but have more regard for legislative laws. It governs a wide range of activities in our society, and has always been the law of the land until sometime in 1860, when the British government acquired portions of land for settlement of free slaves, and the Sierra Leone Company became involved in it. Now, the indigenous knew no other law until about 1880, when the British government, because of the activities of freebooters who plundered the country and disrupted trading activities, had to bring in new legislation. That was the start of government intervention with laws different from customary laws with which the indigenous were well acquainted. However, the colonial government was clever enough not to eradicate customary laws as it would have been to the state. In fact, it was seen in the reception to a new law requiring payment of tax by every house. They were not used to this and raised the question first in the minds of the chiefs if the native laws were to be replaced by the British laws. For the people who were illiterate, they considered whether the taxes meant that their houses now belonged to the government, who was asking them to pay for staying there. That led to what came to be known as the Hot Tax War, then spearheaded by a chief called Baidure. The grant was then paid for a system whereby new laws were gradually introduced alongside customary laws. First was an intrusion into laws related to crimes, removing very serious penalties from the hands of chiefs in the area. There was also customary law in respect of land, different from the general and what became known as statute law, and it remains so today. Land in areas occupied by indigenes has largely been communal or family owned. This continues to today in the provinces. Land is either given to the other free slaves individually by a grant or by the government to individuals, and has led to a dual system of land tenure in the country. Now, looking at religion and customary law, the religion favored by customary law has always been what are referred to as traditional religions. They have been in the communities from time immemorial. The people knew of no other religion but theirs before the advent of a new method of worship. And customary law recognizes and supports traditional religion. This varied and still varied from place to place, but principally have the same notion as in Christianity. There are various groups, but have the same principle. Among the Timnis in the northern province of the country, there is the Poro, which has spread to other parts, arising principally from migration and intermarriages. Among the Mendes, there is the Wuni. The Colors have the Sande, and generally for women, the Wuni. These all have their forms of worship of a deity with various types of sacrifice, and serve their purpose, which has always helped establish customary law and obedience to it. For the men, initiation into the Poro or Wuni society determines marriage and helps preparation to take up responsibility in the society and enter into marriage. It establishes that the man can take care of the family. The same goes for the women in the Bondo society as well as the Sande. Customary law continues to preserve these traditional religions, and this has been supported by provisions in the Constitution furthering human rights. However, certain traditional religious practices have come under question, principally when they relate to women and the criticism of female genital mutilation. Again, these have raised the question of violation of the Constitution. The worship shrines usually referred to as the bush, for example, the Poro bush, are preserved from desecration by customary law, which stipulates punishment for sacrilege by being asked which may tend to defile the bush or expose its secrets. An act of sacrilege may even be founded in having canon knowledge of woman in morning mood. Another important aspect of customary law relates to marriage. Since customary law is unwritten, there is nowhere to find the laws governing marriage. It does have its own procedure, just as the other forms of marriage. The other forms of marriage are governed by our statutes, which are in chapters 95, 96, and 97 of the laws of Sierra Leone, 1960 as amended over the years. Marriages by customary law, though polygamous as under Islamic law, has a number of similarities with the other forms of marriage. One such similarity is the decrease of consanguinity. As stated earlier, there may be slight variations as what is known as simongama under customary law. Not considered if a man has. Customary is not considered if a man has an affair with the sister of the same blood or the wife who is alive. Customary law might generally be a matter for families and not just the couples alone. In short, it is a marriage between families. The woman's parents or guardians must consent, and since they belong to families, they consult the principal members of that family. This is a very important feature of customary law marriage, as the families and communities would not recognize couples who have not consulted families and also go through the procedure. It has its own procedure. It's in two stages, and presents are usually given by both sides, especially at what is known as the cooler stage for short. And the marriage takes place at a later stage. Strangely, under customary law, the practice of slavery continued in a different way from the established unknown form until it was finally abolished on 1st January 1928. The situation was such that the consequences of it remain, and they still remain today. A, if a free man lived with his own slave, she was considered a free woman and married. The children were in his custody. B, while a free man lived with the slave of another, he could redeem her and should be regarded as married, and any child would be in his custody. C, in any other case, the children of a slave woman were considered slaves and the property of her master. In A and B, stated above, if there is a desertion by the woman, she invariably claims there was no marriage and no money was paid. However, whatever money was paid to the master redeemed her, money was deemed to be paid to the mother. The above, as stated, is most unfair and against justice, and an aspect of customary law which should be looked into and some drastic steps taken. I submit that once the following steps have been taken, the offspring are entitled to the throne as children of wives married customary. It is the belief that the god does not consent to the candidate under traditional religion. To ensure that there was no discontent among those governed by customary law, the colonial government did not abolish the chief's cause, which they met, Instead, they were transformed into native authority courts and cleverly removed the paramount chiefs as chairman to avoid misuse of their powers. And later, the Local Courts Act was promulgated in 1963. Though these courts have always had jurisdiction over customary law matters exclusively, they also exercised it in respect of petty crimes of theft to save the time of the magistrate's court. Such courts are however under supervision by the magistrate of the district, who sits as chairman, with two assessors constituting the district appeals court, to which appeals of the local courts go. Thereafter, it may go to the local appeals division of the High Court, then to the Court of Appeal, and finally to the Supreme Court. The danger is that the High Court, a matter may begin to lose the trend of customary law. There is solace in the provisions of Section 76 of the Courts Act as amended, and Section 120 of the Constitution of 1991. Both the Courts Act of 1965 as amended, and the Constitution of 1991 makes reference to equity, good conscience, and natural justice. This has greatly watered down the harshness of customary law, as seen in the local case of Shaheen and Duralia in the Serving Law Reports. In the area of succession under customary law, there has been a steady movement away from practices which are unfair and unjust. Under the customary law of the various tribes, a widow was not entitled to the estate of her deceased husband unless she declares to be for a brother or a member of the family, in which case she can enjoy the estate through him. Before state action in 2007, which will be referred to later, there are decisions at local government denouncing the law as unfair. As soon, much earlier on, in a decision by a paramount chief, later M.K. Jibai III, in a chiefdom called the Concord Chiefdom, and another chiefdom in which another matter of Brie Yagbaje was decided in like manner. And so the ground has been set for the eradication of many parts of customary law, and hence traditional religion would be tampered, because the beliefs of traditional religion were translated and have always been translated into customary law practices. Now, looking at the Constitution, in 1991, a new constitution was promulgated, and the position of customary law was not different. It was fully recognized and provided for by various constitutions since 1961, when independence was gained. However, with the advancement of the need for the protection of human rights, Section 27 of Chapter 3 of the Constitution calls to question certain aspects of customary law. The Constitution is the lifeblood of any state, and its provisions are sacred, and would nullify any act or law which runs counter to any of them. While the local courts are concerned with preserving respect and authority of customary law, they are subject to the Constitution of the country. The Constitution in Chapter 12 and Section 170 provides that the laws of Sierra Leone shall comprise among others the common law. And it goes on in Section 170, subsection 2, to state, the common law of Sierra Leone shall comprise the rules of law generally known as the common law, the rules of law generally known as the doctrines of equity, and the rules of customary law, including those determined by the Superior Court of Judicature. It goes on in Section 170, subsection 2, to state that, I quote, for the purposes of this section, the expression customary law means the rules of law which, by custom, are applicable to particular communities in Sierra Leone. By these provisions, every form of customary law in any community in Sierra Leone is proper under the Constitution. In consequence, all practices will be proper and within the ambit of the law well protected by the Constitution. However, the same constitution tends to nullify certain customary law practices when not seen to be in conformity with provisions under Chapter 3, recognizing and protecting fundamental human rights and the freedom of the individual. Section 27, subsection 1, declares invalid any law which makes provisions which are discriminatory by itself or in its effect. Section 27, subsection 3, explained the different, to mean different treatment to different people attributable to their race, tribe, sex, place of origin, political opinion, color, etc. It would appear that the same constitution is giving and also taking the rights under customary law, and so would interfere with their traditional religious practices. In the light of this, it is a surprise that steps have not been seriously taken to nullify such customary law, which appears repugnant. It would also be interesting to observe that while section 27 subsection 1 prohibits any law that is disclaimed by itself and mistaken, subsection 4 emphasizes situations when it will not apply. As you better understood it, the entire subsection is stated here. It says, one, that it shall not apply to any law so far as that law makes provision A for the appropriation of revenues or other forms of revenue or for the imposition of taxes, etc. B, with respect to persons who are not citizens of Sierra Leone, or C, with respect to persons who acquire citizenship of Sierra Leone by whatever form, and with respect to adoption, marriage, divorce, burial, demolition of property or death, or other interests of personal law. Again, for the application in the case of members of a particular race or tribe of customary law, with respect to any matter to the exclusion of any law, with respect to that matter which is applicable in the case of other persons. Thus, there is a conflict here in that the same constitution we propose to uphold freedom, justice, and human rights promotes an unjust customary law because of the exemptions. The argument may be put forward that the constitution should not conflict with customary law and therefore it would supersede. But it raises the room for questions, hence the difficulty of always having certain legislation, personally. Let me mention the question of customary fees. Now, for state action affecting religion, as a British colony, the state developed a bias towards Christianity, but focused more on the Church of England. It was for this reason that the Cathedral of the Anglican Church in Sierra Leone became the state church. The state was biased in favor of the Anglican Church, but that is because of historical ties. Since the 1970s, there has been a steady march towards liberalism by the state in respect of religion. It has tried to ensure that Christians and Muslims are treated equally. In any state of public function, when prayers are to be offered, they are done good ways. The state has taken steps to ensure that a number of pilgrims are sponsored to the arch each year because it is a secular state and has since colonial times had a path towards Christianity. Such action will bridge the gap and cement people of all religions together. But, however, the customary religious fees, traditional religions, have not enjoyed such patronage, though they are not different in principle from the others. The mainstream religions worship a god, no matter the name given it. It is still one god they are worshiping. Religions based on customary beliefs also worship one god. They are not pagans. The difference depending on the local custom is what is taken to represent God. It may be a tree, may be a stone, may be a river, but they are still worshiping a god, because they believe life comes through that God whom they worship by being represented by the stone, the tree, the river, whatever it is, not two gods. They still believe in one God, as in the mainstream religions. Now, finally, there has been state action in various legislation in recent times. The first one, the Devolution of Estates Act 2007, which has applied to the estate of persons irrespective of religion or ethnic origin, and consequently has affected the states and succession linked to customary law and Muslim law. Now, the more radical intervention on customary law is seen in the game, the registration of customary law, marriage, and divorce act of 2007. From time immemorial, people who practice customary law were illiterate and had no interest in writing. The idea of registration never arose. This law has deviated from the absence of registration process the one in which parties to such measures of divorce are required to register such and obtain a certificate. This, in effect, takes it out of customary law and into the realm of statute law and in line with marriages and divorce under the general law. A similar intrusion is observed in succession to the estates governed by customary law by the Devolution of Estates Act 2007. Persons who follow traditional religions consider certain practices taboo to be performed by women. To them, the gods do not allow such and may invite a curse on the family. For example, in some parts, a woman cannot be head of a bush where perhaps she has to perform certain rites. The impact of state intervention, in my view, through legislation, will encourage people who practice traditional religions to move more towards civil marriage, etc., provided for it, the laws of Sierra Leone, and may decide to hold on to the Muslim faith, which is nearest, or be converted to Christianity, which means it is not of their own freedom. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Manuel Chef, who's our guest speaker, Francois.
Thank you, Chair. On the program, I'm billed as Dean. That was true until exactly 14 days ago. As you know, how it goes, old deans don't die, they just lose their faculties. In order to keep myself out of trouble with the chairperson, I've got 7 pages to read. 7 pages should take 15 minutes. In 1995, the Zimbabwean High Court refused to admit a Rastafarian to legal practice due to his dreadlocked hairstyle. On appeal to the Supreme Court, the High Court's refusal was found to be unconstitutional on the basis that the applicant's freedom of religion and of conscience was to be protected. The courts, it was said, were not to determine the validity or attraction of religious beliefs, but was to concern themselves only with the sincerity of the applicant's beliefs. In 1996, the President of Mozambique referred a bill passed by the national legislature in terms of which public holidays were to be declared on 2 religious Islamic festivals to the Supreme Court. The Constitution provided and still provides for the principle of secularity of the state and respect for all religious denominations. The court declared the bill unconstitutional on the basis that the state was called upon to maintain religious neutrality. In 2001, the Tanzanian Court of Appeal quashed the conviction by a lower court and the sentence of imprisonment of a member of an Islamic organization for urging non-Muslims to embrace the Islamic faith and stating that Jesus Christ was not the Son of God. The Court of Appeal found that the freedom of religion guaranteed the profession, practice, and propagation of faith and belief, and that sober and temperate criticisms of other religions are not prohibited by law. In 2006, both the Ugandan Constitutional Court and Supreme Court turned down an application by university students belonging to the Seventh-day Adventist Church to be allowed not to attend lectures or write exams on their Saturday. The Supreme Court found that although reasonable steps should be taken to accommodate religious beliefs, although not at the cost of undue interference or expense to the university, whereby its ability to provide education to a diverse and multi-religious community would be affected negatively. Now, these are only a few examples from some African states demonstrating the difficulties involved in the question how the modern constitutional state should deal with the reality of religious, the reality of its citizenry, which I've referred to earlier. The problem is by no means one characteristic only of African jurisdictions. In fact, the nature and ubiquitousness of questions regarding the manner in which the state and its institutions should deal with issues pertaining to religious plurality and the protection of the relevant rights have global dimensions, as was also mentioned earlier. The difficulties arising from these issues are also not limited either to the North or the South, the First or the Third World, or established or new democracies. Even a cursory glance at the history and current practices in many countries shows that clear-cut answers to the constitutional state's responsibilities regarding religion are not available. And the courts, legislatures, governments, and even scholars tend to avoid the intractable problems attending the matter by taking refuge behind notions such as neutrality and secularity. Apart from the fact that the global mobility of the multi-religious human race is increasingly affecting all countries, undemocratic states are by their nature less concerned with judicial or religious justice. However, due to, amongst other things, the effects of globalization, constitutionalism has gained and is gaining global relevance. Religion is based upon belief, which has only limited potential for rational explanation, as the Bishop told us also. Religious communities sharing a physical space and subject to a single governmental authority do tend to become competitive, and then not on the basis of reasonable argument. Religious teachings frequently call for tolerance, peace, and love, but history and contemporary occurrences in various parts of the world show us that religious competition has a huge potential for bloody warfare. In the constitutional state, it is the function of the authorities to preserve peace and social stability, also in the religiously plural population, by employing the law. Thank you, Bishop. In our universal current conception of the state, the problem of the division of authority between church and state goes back at least to the 5th century when St. Augustine talked about two cities, one the city of God for the pious, and the other the city of sinful man, the two cities uncomfortably coexisting until the end of time. In 494, Pope Boniface laid down the notion of two powers, the one sacred, that of the Pope, and the other royal, that of the Emperor. In the 11th to the 13th centuries, during the Papal Revolution, this was developed into the two swords doctrine, separating the temporal, the state, from the spiritual, the Roman Church. At the hands of Luther and Calvin in the 15th century, the Reformation introduced the doctrine of two kingdoms as a variation, but also a continuation of the essential idea that people are simultaneously bound to submit to both the religious and secular authorities, each within its domain. Ending the 30 years' war that raged devastatingly across Western Europe to a large degree between Catholics and Protestants, the Peace of Westphalia of 1648 established, in effect, religious freedom as the first constitutionally protected fundamental right. This was done by means of an agreement among the parties that citizens whose religion differed from that of the rulers should be tolerated by those rulers. It was also mentioned this morning, previous media news leading. Some consider the secularization of the state to mean merely the termination of ecclesiastical domination by the state. The common wisdom seems to be that secular is the opposite of religious. Etymologically, the distinction is most probably found in the two cities, two swords, two kingdoms doctrines referred to just now. In the contemporary context, there is, however, more to it. Secularization bears the connotation that religious conviction has no role to play in public affairs, while non-religious considerations must steer the conduct of the state and its organs, as though only religion engenders prejudice and rational decision-making guarantees justice. Being secular is, however, far from being neutral, and even less conducive to objectivity. It is therefore unavoidable that secularism, properly understood, itself essentially expresses a religious attitude. Not surprisingly, for those not subscribing to a secular stance, the notion bears a very negative meaning. It is clear that the range of religious or religion-related legal issues is very broad, and that judicial opinions on dealing with religious conflicts vary widely, despite the frequent refuge that judges take to secularism. I would even submit that constitutions, courts, and legislatures that take the secular and neutral route are adding heat to a sealed steam kettle while they intend or sometimes treat them merely to stir the melting pot. The stream of legal controversies caused by religious plurality arising in constitutional states is not diminishing. There really is no way for the state to hide from the realities of religious pluralism. Constitutionalism being the flavor of the century naturally does not mean that all and sundry, including dictatorships and pseudo-democracies, are conforming to the good standards of constitutionalism. In fact, the real constitutional states are still a minority of the United Nations members. Although such states, the constitutional states, are endowed with political stature and economic power far exceeding their numbers. These instances that practice constitutionalism serve as role models for those who have learned to talk the talk of good governments despite their failures of walking the walk. Put bluntly, due to the internationalization of constitutionalism, acknowledgement that constitutionalism does not prevail in a particular state has become, fortunately, cause for embarrassment for authorities in the state responsible. Constitutionalism thus provides us with a benchmark for balanced state behavior in the exercise of executive, legislative, and judicial authority when confronted with the realities of religious pluralism. In closing, where should we be looking for solutions? Obviously, I won't be able to do that in 4 minutes, but I'd like to suggest at least one little step forward. In the Christian era in Europe, which was also the era of the emergence of the nation state, currently the cornerstone of national and international legal orders, it was not only possible but also required that the prevailing religious sentiments of society, that is Christianity in its various configurations at the time, be respected, protected, and supported by emperors, kings, and governments. Long-lasting and pervasive wars among European Christians, frequently founded upon real or supposed religious differences, make it clear that it was already difficult enough to deal with pluralism within one belief system. In the course of European history, conflict across fundamentally different systems, especially between Christianity and Islam, were exacerbated by raw struggles for territorial and political power. One thinks about the Crusades and the Moors in Spain and so on. In short, subjective religious partisanship of the rulers was understood at the time to be justified. With the exception of the remaining Islamic kingdoms and republics today, that is no longer the case. The religious pluralism in the 21st century of the populations of most states is such that religiously partial governance brings about injustice towards significant components of society adhering to religious groups not sponsored by the state. Contemporary demands on the constitutional state do not countenance systematic injustice and discrimination in any shape or form. In dealing with religious pluralism, the essential conceptual problem of constitutionalism is that it is itself embedded in a particular theoretical or philosophical discipline and foundation. Constitutionalism itself is not neutral, but has evolved over centuries into a coherent and globally accepted and supported complex of norms. The correctness of state conduct under constitutionalism is measurable against coherent norms that are known and understood universally. Interestingly, the global striving to conform to those norms are not consistently driven by the theoretical and philosophical foundations upon which they rest. They seem to have led a life of their own. This calls for elaboration, but I don't have time for that now. To make the point here that state engagement with religion should be objective as opposed to neutral, I'm therefore assuming that the norms of constitutionalism have achieved global acceptance without dependence on its historical, humanistic, and liberal roots. Suffice it to say that if that were not the case, liberal democracy would have had to be the constitutional creed of all states with constitutional law and allowed for juridical, especially judicial, limitation of state authority, constitutional supremacy of state, human dignity as core constitutional value, and the entrenchment and protection of fundamental rights. These are also key premises that are reflected in international law, being in treaties, jurisprudence, and customary international law. I maintain that secularism is not neutral. Religion cannot be switched off arbitrarily. The eternity is in any bit a cop-out. The eternity means not taking sides. It is easily confused with objectivity, which means not being prejudiced. Put differently, neutrality is bland, it's colorless, not engaged. Neutrality entails the supposition that subjectivity can be avoided, or worse, it supposes indifference. Presenting secularity as being neutral is therefore false, since a secular stance displays a powerful subjective mentality. Objectivity, on the other hand, signifies acknowledgement of one's natural subjectivity, as a point of departure, followed by a consciously impartial engagement and the weighing of the matter in terms of predetermined external non-subjective standards. Constitutionalism provides such standards. It also requires justification according to disclosed objective criteria. No state or its organs can hope to succeed in their institutional tasks in the 21st century by presuming that engagement with religion can be eliminated from the constitutional function of maintaining good and just social peace and order. It is not the function of the constitutional state to defend or maintain any specific religion, but it must objectively, not secularly or neutrally, promote religious tolerance and search for a fair balancing of the religious interests of all, even where such balancing requires adherence of contending religions to forfeit some privileges. Thank you.